Thanks for downloading the Charlie Higson and Friends podcast, which originally broadcast on Scala Radio, a station where we have fun with classical music. It's home to Penny Smith, Simon Mayo, Mark Kermode, and me, Charles Nove. And you can find us on DAB Digital Radio, scalaradio.co.uk, and on the Scala app. Right, over to you, Charlie.
Hello and welcome to Charlie Higson and Friends. I am Charlie Higson, and my friend today is Armando Iannucci.
Yes, you have my friendship for 24 hours.
Oh, it's marvellous.
Yeah. It's on loan.
And we, I mean, our paths crossed quite a lot in the 90s. So we had very similar careers in that we were both comedy writers, performers, and crucially for me, producers.
Yes.
And
I always remember being very intrigued about you because I thought, who is this other writer, producer, performer?
Well, that was exactly what I felt about you. I thought, you know, this is the guy doing what I like to do. Mm. And you know, inevitably I always think, well, Armando's better than me.
No, it's like make funny things. I think when people ask me what I do, I can't decide if is it writing, is it, and I just say I just like making funny things.
Which is a great job to have.
Yeah, and I never see it as a job. I remember when I think my middle one, they're all grown up now, but when Marcello was about 8, he said, "What do you do, Dad?" And I said, "I write jokes." He went, "That's not work. You don't work."
I mean, yeah, but at the same time, it was often quite hard work.
It was very hard work and stupid hours as well. Yes. And you wanted to get it right. If you were...
And also, mainly, you know, you're also working with other people who have minds and of their own.
And personalities.
And don't always want to do what you tell them to do.
No. Every now and then, the idea of just an office life where you are the manager seems like a good idea. You know, you can just tell people what to do. But it's not like that in the creative... I was going to say the creative industries, but that makes it sound like work again. The creative arts. It's not like that, is it? It's people just sort of looking like they're dossing around, but actually working in quite a focused way.
Mm. And people always say to me, oh, it must have been such fun making the Fast Show. And you think, yeah, there were moments that were fun, but mostly you remember trying to film something on location somewhere where you've run out of time, it's raining, people haven't learnt their lines, you haven't got the right props for the sketch, and you're just tearing
it is,
your hair
I'd
out.
Say, it is possibly the hardest and most dangerous job in the world, what we do. And
but you still, I mean, you still do. I have slightly moved away from the comedy producing, in the comedy making world. But you've persevered and you followed the route of, which was everybody's dream. Oh, let's go to America and make proper shows.
That was just to kind of, you know, go back a little bit on what we were saying, it has, I found it mostly enjoyable, otherwise I would have stopped. Mm. And I think when a project is not fun, as well as something you can be proud of, then I think it's time to move on. I've enjoyed the hard work, if you see what I mean, when I feel it's going in the right direction. But if it's hard work and you just think, why are we doing this? Then that's the point where you reconsider.
But, you know, I've always felt an affinity with you because I have always felt that you are someone who cares about the craft of it and that you want to make something as best as you possibly can. It's not just, let's make some stuff because someone wants.
No, and I've never had a production company because I've always had this nightmare of feeling, I hate this show, but we've got to have another series, otherwise these 60 people will be out of a job, and I'm going to have to be the one handing out the redundancy notices.
I remember when Vic and Bob set up production company. Yeah. Within a year, they were making Celebrity Dog Training School.
Yes.
And you kind of think that's not why you went into TV.
No, I didn't go into it.
So much as it is fun to talk about our careers in the hardest job in the world, this is a music station.
Yeah.
So we better play some music.
Well, this would be easy then, wouldn't it? I'm working here. Must be easy. Away from the hard comedy.
But I mean, you probably couldn't tell, but I'm not really a professional radio presenter. But
No, that came across. You carry it well.
Well, the idea, part of why I wanted to make this show was to make classical music feel more accessible, that it's not some kind of elitist thing. So, let's start by playing one of the first pieces of music that you sort of loved as a child and came across music and discovered that there was this thing that wasn't pop music.
There was this thing, yes. Because I grew up in a tenement flat in Glasgow, sharing a room with my brother. My other brother as well, they were into Deep Purple and Pink Floyd and King Crimson and all the shades of red.
Where did you fit in? Were you in the middle?
And I was the third. Right, so I was the youngest of three, and then I had a younger sister. And I sort of felt, I want my noise. What's my noise? Mm. And I remember thinking my Oldfield was interesting, but I think the reason I felt my Oldfield was interesting was he did big, long, slightly symphonic pieces, really. And then I remember first music appreciation class at school, the teacher dropped the needle onto Mars, the first of the planets, holds the planets. I thought, that's my noise. It's the orchestra.
So many people who got into classical music, I think the Planet Suite was a sort of gateway music, wasn't
absolutely,
it?
Absolutely, gateway.
Because it sort of tells a story, because most classical music is abstract, essentially. It is.
And you can take this either way, you can take these pieces as abstract or not. I mean, obviously Mars Bringer, there's a very military sound to it, but it's just beautiful music as well. Jupiter and, Saturn is this mysterious, very kind of mystical, weird, almost cinematic music. And a lot of those composers, British composers of the 1930s and 40s also, earned their keep by writing film music.
Yeah, and so much film music has been influenced by the Planet Suite.
Exactly,
Hans Zimmer's made a career of ripping off Mars Bringer of War.
I think he's sort of added to it rather than ripped it off.
He's
enhanced the experience.
Was influenced by.
Was influenced and paid tribute retrospectively to.
I have to be careful what I say.
Yes.
Hans Zimmer refuses to let any of his music be played on Scala Radio.
But I remember also roughly that time thinking, what is this? I want to get more. And I was very lucky. We live in this tenement flat and Byers Road in Glasgow, and then just down, two blocks down, they just opened the Hillhead Library, a new public library. So it was all spanking new and had a magnificent classical music section, vinyl, which, you could join, and I could just explore this music for free.
This will mean nothing to younger listeners. That I probably have any younger
listeners. The words vinyl,
it's like, you have to go to a special building to get music.
So the words library and vinyl mean nothing to this. I know, it sounds crazy, but that's what we did.
It made it special, didn't it?
I know. These were the times, for our younger listeners, this was the time when also you had to stand up and walk across to the television to change channel. Mm. I mean, can you imagine? Absolute nightmare.
Although my kids don't hardly ever watch the TV anyway.
Are they watching
it's all
tiny
computer
little...
computer and phones. Yeah. But as a complimentary piece to the very martial music of... Mars, the Bringer of War, I listened to a lot when I was a kid, because I think particularly as a boy, you like those loud, banging, fast, noisy pieces. And there's a certain military air to Kachaturian's Sabre Dance. Mm. And I actually first came across that music, like a lot of people of my generation, the version, the rock version by Love Sculpture, which was Dave Edmonds.
I think at that time... Is this that we're talking about the 70s, late 70s, early 80s?
There was early 70s for me.
There was this strange fusion of prog rock and classical. Rick Wakeman doing that.
Well, Rick Wakeman presented a series on Scala, which is still available if you want to listen to it, of that crossover between rock music.
I remember at the time on Radio Clyde, which was our local station, on Sunday night there was Baroque and Roll, which was. which I tried to listen to, but it was. It was always. By episode four, they were struggling to make the connection between the two.
Probably a good short series or a one-off.
Yeah, I remember The Six Wives of Henry VIII by Rick Wakeman.
Oh, my Lord.
And things like that. And E.L.
Pictures at an exhibition, of course.
Yeah. So there was an element of that. But in the end, I decided that's not good enough. That's them trying to approach classical music, and it's nice that they do, but actually I want the real thing.
And so you carried on listening to classical music, obviously.
Yeah, absolutely. It became... And the great joy of having this library was that, you know, of course you can do it on streaming services now, but you could just explore it. You could take a risk. Mm. You know, you could come across a composer that you never heard of, Sibelius. Who's this Sibelius? Lots of pictures of sort of Finnish kind of landscapes and so on. What's that all about? And I didn't have to, you know, I could just borrow it, you know, and listen to it. And if I really liked it, I could go back and listen to more Sibelius.
Did you have to listen in your bedroom with your brothers?
Well, yes.
Did you have to fight over access to the hi-fi?
Well, there was a bit of that, yes. And so I listened with headphones on because, you know, we had to share a room. And I tend to do it with... while doing homework. So I had a makeshift, because it was quite cramped, I had a makeshift desk, which was just a board over my chair. And I would do my maths homework with the headphones on, listening to, you know, Sibelius' Third Symphony or Mahler. I was a great Mahler fan because I managed to game the system at the library, which was you were allowed to take three discs out. But Mahler, his symphonies were so long, they were double albums. Mm. So I was getting a kind of special fourth.
Well, I remember my dad came home from the music library with Siegfried, the Wagner opera, which was about 10 LPs.
Yes, yes.
So that was great.
And that's just one ticket. Just one. So he's got more. And then in the Govan Library, they had an even bigger classical music section, and they had scores. So you could take scores. I couldn't read music, but I tried taking out a score of a Beethoven symphony and the disc and sort of following it at home. I found it quite exciting. But I didn't have friends. No, I did have friends.
I was going to say, did you have friends who shared your interest in music? Your headphones on and your maths?
No, I did have one or two. And it was very much at the time. And this kind of is indicative of how we... of the image classical music has. I did feel it was like a kind of guilty, kind of tawdry secret that you mustn't mention to other people because they'll despise you because they were into, you know, the successors of the Floyds and the Purples and the Crimsons, you know.
But you weren't put off and you still loved...
No, I wasn't. I was quite defiant about it, actually.
I asked you beforehand what was your... favourite piece of music. It's impossible to pick a favourite. So let's say it's among your favourites.
Yes.
And you went for the Bach Goldberg variations.
Yes.
The aria.
Yes.
Beautiful piano music played by Glenn Gould.
Yes. The thing about Glenn Gould is he was notorious for making lots of noises. He couldn't stop making noises.
I know, it's great.
Playing.
You can hear him humming in the background.
If you put your head right up to this, you can hear him.
That's what I love about it.
Yeah. And they went to great lengths to dampen the, you know, they put all sorts of dampeners and curtains and everything around. So he was more or less boxed in while playing the piano, and still
he still got past them.
Yes,
which I mean, Jack Nicholson in Five Easy Pieces plays a pianist who I assume is based on Glenn.
Right, right.
Sort of having a midlife crisis, and his thing in that is he can't stop
humming,
singing,
making
along
it, yeah,
to the music,
and it's
playing.
Sort of. I mean, sometimes it can be grating if you hear the odd. The various conductors and cellists who go, you know, when they swoop up, which is off-putting. But there's something endearing about Glenn Gould's kind of inability to stop expressing his enthusiasm.
Well, it's like a tennis player with their grunt.
Yes, that's right. Can you imagine that? I mean, she's a beautiful violinist, but just the grunts.
Yeah.
Every 5 seconds.
I love Philip Glass.
Oh, right.
And I've played him a lot on my shows. Mm. I particularly like Philip Glass because it's great music to write to. Mm-hmm. And would have been perfect music for you to do your homework to.
I imagine
back
so.
Back in the day.
Yes. I remember watching Kajanaskatchi when it came out, just wondering where was this music from. It felt otherworldly.
Yeah, and, you know, and that combination of the cinema and the music in that piece has been so influential on so many films that have come since.
Charlie Higson and Friends on Scala Radio.
So, Armando, you were talking before about growing up in the tenement in Glasgow. How did you get from there to the BBC?
Well, I loved radio comedy. You know, that's what I grabbed. That's why I was just a huge admirer of, you know, the regular shows like the News Quiz, and we had Weekending at the time, which I remember thinking at the time was just the sharpest wit ever. But looking back, it was dreadful. But it did nurture lots and lots of amazing producing and writing talent.
So you were more excited by the radio rather than the TV comedy?
I think so. Maybe. I mean, there was great stuff on television. You know, there's Python and there was Morecambe and Wise and Bruce's Generation Game and Steptoe and so on. But and Spike Milligan's Q series, which I got, but no one else in my family did. So the chances of being able to persuade them to watch it as a unit, very slim. But on the radio, this was when Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy came out on the radio. And I think I still have my illegally copied off the airwaves recordings on cassette of the first transmission of Hitchhiker's Guide. And you can hear at 11 p.m. the Radio Tirana from when Radio Albania was under a kind of totalitarian regime, and they would broadcast Radio Tirana to the west, and you could hear the signal at 11 o'clock just coming through on the shortwave and the medium wave thing. So there on thing, but the Hitchhiker's Guide for me was the first time I thought, oh, comedy's more than just jokes and sketches. It's about ideas and story.
And did you think, I'd like to do that? And was it possibly that radio felt like an easier way in?
I don't know, but I certainly felt that's what I want to do, something like that.
How did you progress? What was your first step?
First of all, and it was through a series of possibly quite Machiavellian stages. I thought, who are all these people? They all seem to go to Oxford and Cambridge. Right, I'll apply for Oxford.
So I did that.
And that, well, no, so not so I could get into radio, just to get into comedy, right? And then I spent my whole undergraduate time in Oxford not doing any comedy. So, however, I did stay on and do a PhD, and that's when I did start doing comedy and taking stuff up to the Edinburgh Festival.
So were you part of the...
I was in the Oxford Review.
Right.
Yeah.
With?
David Schneider, who I work a lot with, was the one who had gone just before me.
Right.
And just after me was like Stuart Lee and Richard Herring.
Right.
But I remember at the time being up in Edinburgh and just going to see these amazing shows like Theatre de Complicité and so on, and just thinking, oh, I've got to go back and do a Star Trek sketch now. I mean, it was very funny, but fundamentally I just thought, I have to rethink now comedy and be a little bit more, try and take more risks, I suppose. And then, as fate would have it, Radio Scotland were going through a bit of a reform and were looking for younger presenters to speak to the youth. Because at the time, Radio Scotland was mostly sort of... It had an older listenership, shall we say. And they were looking for some comedy stuff. So I sent them a tape of some of my stuff and they liked it, and I went up and chatted to them. And I got a job presenting a music show every Wednesday night, along with Eddie Mayer. But my job was also to write comedy. And what I did was I used Radio Scotland as a kind of testing ground, really, because I could get, if I wanted to do a spoof news sketch, I could get the news reporter. I could, do you know what I mean? If I wanted to do a spoof sports commentary, I could get the sports reporter because they knew how to do it. I'd just give them the things to say. I'd give them the and we'd edit it. I'd get a sports editor to edit it. You know, so I just picked up all the techniques of radio, but I was also allowed to write comedy and direct it and produce it, really, and use sound effects. And so it was a real training ground. And so on the basis of that, I then applied to become a radio producer in London. So it's a series of... It makes it sound like I've mapped it all out like that, but it was a series of kind of...
No, well, I mean...
Where's the power here? How can I use the power in the room?
My career was totally arbitrary. I had no planning at all. We're going to chill out.
Mm.
You were talking before about your love of Marla, mainly because you got more value for your money
yes.
in terms of the number of LPs
you
could get under one ticket from the library.
Yeah.
And this is a piece from Mahler's Symphony No. 4, the third movement. When I was talking to Amendo before we started about what might be a piece of music that you would relax to or chill out.
It's very much, if you've had a really busy day and you just open the door, dumped your bag, switched the lights on, if you put that on, it's an audible sigh of relief, that piece of music, I find.
And you do that. That's not just something you fantasise about.
I audibly kind of sigh or dump the bag on the floor. And I do a bit of that, yeah.
Do you listen? Are you a vinyl snob? Do you have to listen on vinyl or is it just
streamed? No, I'm not now, no. And I also find as you get older, your kind of hearing tends to kind of get a bit compromised anyway. So I tend to be like a headphones person, nothing too loud. But I just a good speaker also, I just find, you know, about the house. I don't need something to make it sound like there genuinely is a 90-piece orchestra in the room. I don't feel that way inclined. Also, you know, because I grew up with my father playing Italian opera really, really loudly. I mean, so loudly that both the the family below and the family above us would bang the floor and the ceiling at roughly the same time. And I knew it drove us slightly crazy, so I'd never want to inflict that on my family, really, who, you know, who have other musical tastes.
Do any of your kids listen to...
Oh, yes, no, absolutely. And it was a lovely time with Emilio, my eldest, for my birthday, he took me to a performance of The Planets.
Ah.
And he has my vinyl recording of The Planets, which was one of the first albums I ever bought, really. He has that at home. So, and that was very nice.
Yeah, I mean, I remember my dad taking me to... probably would have been a prom at the Albert Hall with The Planets suite.
Yes. I remember taking my dad to a concert Scottish National Orchestra were playing. But it was Stravinsky, and I could see he wasn't really... he was having none of it. I mean, was enjoying it. I thought it was tremendous.
It's interesting, though, isn't it, you know, that Stravinsky is considered difficult and modern, but it's
he's amazing.
100 years old.
Of course, it's 100 years old, and there's elements of jazz and blues and all sorts of folk. But just the invention and the way he reinvented himself as well throughout his career is amazing. A lot of modern music... is not modern. That's the thing. The whole avant-garde kind of atonal, that was the 1920s and 1910s.
Yeah, but, you know, people still push against it. It's interesting at the proms, the BBC always puts on a new piece.
Yeah.
Which starts it. And they're often quite difficult.
Yeah.
And I go to the proms quite a lot and I just tell myself, oh, I'm watching a horror film. This is horror film music.
Well, I sat in on there's this group that I'm associated with called the Apollo Musics Project, and they bring classical music into sort of inner city schools that maybe not have the resources and so on. And one session they did was they were a quartet, and they asked the kids who were about 10 or 11 to improvise a story, and there was a horror story, and they improvised the music to it, and they put it all together, and then they played a piece of Shostakovich string quartet, and the kids wrote down what they thought the story was, and the two pieces of music were slightly similar in that they lots of dynamic changes and different, you know, lots very expressive and kept shifting and so on, and I thought they've introduced a class of 10 and 11-year-olds to Shostakovich, you know, a mid-20th century composer, without them thinking, this is hard, or this is not for the likes of us, or this is going to be difficult, or when does this lesson finish? And you know, we've had, you know, Philip Glass, Holst was, you know, there's amazing pieces of music that I think connect with people that were written in the 20th century. So I think we write it off as a kind of period.
And through TV and film, people listen to a lot of what you could describe as avant-garde classical
music. I mean, if you take a Bernard Herrmann score from Psycho or something, very dissonant, very, you know, aggressive, very rhythmic, you know. But, you know, given the context, it's amazing. Mm.
So, Armando, you were talking before about how you used working on radio in Scotland as a sort of Petri dish to develop your ideas. And I first came across your name, and probably most people did, for On the Hour.
Right.
She did on Radio 4, which, how much of that was based on your time at Radio
Scotland? There was a little bit of that. And also, you know, when I came to London, I heard this show on Capital called The Way It Is, which was their news at 7 o'clock. And it was very on Radio 4. It was like, it's 7 o'clock, this is The Way It Is. And they had like a kind of sonorous voice for every category. So it would go, the weather, you know, and things like, horse racing, you know, and I just, this is bonkers. But I thought, what if we marry that with a Radio 4 sound? There might be something in it. And I went on a training course. One of the first things they do when you join as a producer, they put me on a training course with other researchers, producers, presenters. And we were there for 2 weeks. And one of the projects was you got into a group of three and you had to come up with a 10-minute magazine show. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, I don't want to do that. I want to do, you know, I want to do comedy. So why don't we do a fake news magazine show? Because we had a news reporter there and we had a sports presenter there, you know. And I got them together and we did this little dummy tape of it, everything absolutely serious. and I did a... an item. It was Britain's first three-way boxing match. where, and I thought, what we'll do is we'll interview, we'll give the people the jokes, but to say in their own words, and then I'll edit it together as if I've gone out and actually interviewed them and cut it together as a genuine piece, you know, a genuinely edited piece, just to get the rhythm of it, and then put in jingles saying, you know, motorways tonight and things like that, and. We all really enjoyed it. And I thought, well, that was it. But I gave it to the then head of comedy at Radio 4, Jonathan James Moore, the legendary Jonathan James Moore. And he said, "This, we must make this." So we did a pilot. I got in contact with Chris Morris, who was on London, GLR it was.
That's
at the
right,
time.
Yes.
Doing spoof, kind of news, spoof DJs.
Was he doing his DJ, Wayne?
Wayne Carr in the morning. And he would go out and about and do little spoof box pops. And so I just got in touch with him and said, look, I like what you do. I'm doing this thing. Do you want to meet up? And we did. And we turned out to be roughly the same age and had the same interests. And he similarly had gone through into comedy via a local radio background as opposed to a performing background. He was very musical, loved the texture of radio and all that.
But it also got that idea of the more straight and serious you do it, the funnier
exactly.
it is.
Exactly. There's no raised eyebrows at all. No kind of absolutely play it down.
And did you put together the whole of the team? Because that was the first time people were aware of Steve Coogan and Alan Partridge.
David Schneider, and I got in touch with people like Patrick Marber, Dune McKeon, I'd worked with on, I produced several seasons of the Mary Whitehouse Experience on Radio 1. So I'd worked with Dune and I got in touch with Steve. I saw him doing impressions and stuff on television. And I got in touch and said, look, I'm just after a team that can play things for real, can improvise a bit and could do different voices when required.
And you know? And Leon Herring, had you kept in touch with them?
I had as a weekending producer,
right?
Because you each do a stint. It's like slopping out, you know. It's your first year,
wasn't it? Yeah.
You know, you do 8 weeks of weekending,
you write gags for them.
And I remember.
But you know, I mean, that was an extraordinary lineup you got for that.
Yeah.
Radio.
Well, we didn't know at the time, other than these are all funny people. Let's hope it gels. I think there was a point where the first time I asked them to slightly improvise around a story. And especially when Steve just, you know, he can improvise for hours. Mm. I think we all realised we were onto something. We didn't think it would be a big thing, but we thought it might be a nice kind of niche thing that some people might enjoy. And also Chris's amazing talents.
How many series did you do?
We did two series of it, plus a Christmas special.
And then repurposed it for TV.
And then pretty soon after the first series... The first series also spawned Knowing Me, Knowing You with Alan Partridge. Again, because as soon as Steve was Alan, we just knew there was more to this character than just presenting sport, which was probably the idea in his head as well, Alan's head, which is I don't want to be a sports reporter for the rest of my life. I have bigger things to do. So we knew while we were doing second season, tell how American I've become. Season.
Everyone calls them seasons.
When we were approaching the season finale of season one, series one of On the Hour, we knew the BBC were interested.
So as early as that, you were moving on.
Yeah. Yeah. And I didn't quite know what to do professionally in terms of stay at the as a radio producer, and I took the leap to go freelance or leave the BBC, thinking, okay,
so when it became the day-to-day,
yeah,
you produced that.
Yes. I remember my first interview, my first sort of meeting with BBC Television Light Entertainment, in which they said, no, someone else will produce it and someone else will direct it. I said, why? And they said, well, you know, you're a radio producer, but we'll get people in to do it. And I said, well, you know, people can... John Cleese, you know, knew what he was doing with Fawlty Towers. You put the creators in touch, and he actually said, yeah, if you look at some of the lighting in some of those Fawlty Towers episodes, the lighting. And so I said, do you know what, BBC, you're not going to make this. So I took it away from the BBC and started sniffing around independent production companies to make it instead. So there I was, freelance, having left the BBC and then telling BBC Television, no. It was a slightly kind of... I felt
that was very bold and brave.
I only feel that now.
The arrogance of youth.
I think it probably was. I just thought, we've got to get this right. We can't. Yeah. We can't have, a 50-year-old in a pink sweater, who's drunk every lunchtime at the BBC club, in charge of this show.
Yeah. Well, it was like when Paul and I came to make Paul Whitehouse. That is.
Yes.
Just one of my other friends, who I also did one of these shows with, which you can listen to now as a podcast via Scala Radio. A bit of salesmanship.
Yeah. It's called 360 Broadcasting.
360
isn't it?
Broadcasting. Yeah.
Multi-platforming.
So when we came to do the Fast Show, we went to all the obvious producers except you. Well, you were busy with your own stuff. There was John Lloyd, who's amazing.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Jeffrey Perkins, who we'd worked with on Harry's stuff, and had basically taught me everything I knew about making comedy and being a producer. That was about it, really. They weren't available or didn't want to do it for whatever reasons. And it was John Lloyd who said, look, you should do it.
Yeah.
You know the show inside out. There's no sort of great secret to producing. I mean, I never really got involved in the whole sort of... the business side of it, the contracts and the deals and all
but
that.
You can
leave that to someone else.
Exactly.
But
you get
as a creative, and I think, as was said at the very top of this programme, that was why I felt that affinity with you, that we were both creative producers of our own stuff.
Mm. And when you're writing something, you're playing it out in your head anyway. Mm. You know how it should look. As you're watching the shot, you get a feel for where the funny is. And
I mean, that being said, there are quite a lot of writers who want nothing to do with the actual creative process and having to deal with people and actors.
No, I know.
Here's a script, go and make it, give me the money, I'm going to go and write something else.
But I've often found it weird that quite a lot of shows, mostly dramas rather than comedies, operate without the writer there. You know, the writer hands over the script and then the director picks up the script and goes off and makes it, and the writer doesn't really know what's happening until he or she sees it going out. And I've always felt that odd. So when I'm doing anything, when I think of it, any TV show or any film, I always have the writers around and on set. Mm. And, if the cast want to play with something about, a scene, look at a scene again, there's a writer there to go and talk to.
Taking you back to your younger days, I asked beforehand if there was a piece of music that you particularly remember a performance of and how that affected you, and you chose Walton's Balthazar's Feast. And what was it that had such an effect on you?
So I didn't know this piece at all, and I went to, with some of my friends who I could share the classical music secrets with, we went to they did a prom season at Glasgow as well, at the Kelvin Hall, and I remember standing there, so quite near the orchestra, and a massive chorus as well, hearing this piece, which I'd never heard, didn't know anything about, and being absolutely sort of blown away by it. There's a bit in the middle of it which it's quite hedonistic. It's them praising gold and bronze and food and stuff like that, but Walton goes for it, evil and depravity is always much more interesting to a writer or a composer than... when I spent 3 years trying to write a thesis about Paradise Lost, and the great bits in Paradise Lost is when Satan speaks.
Yeah, I mean, there's a certain sort of heavy metal vibe to it, isn't it? With the massed choir, it's sort of similar to, the, I suppose, the Fortuna from
Carmina right.
Burana and the Dies Irae from the
Verdi.
Yeah,
and I think it's probably the first waltz that I'd heard as well. So again, you know, straight after the concert, I could rush to the Hillhead Public Library on Byers Road, still there. And
get your headphones on
and get your
and shake your head
and take out
to Belshazzar's feast.
But were you able to commune your love of classical music with, you know, contemporaries?
Well, not to a huge amount. I mean, I would go with my parents quite a lot, but I would. It was mostly solitary listening. I would listen after school. I would. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't go for headphones. I'd put the speakers, lie on the floor and put the speakers on either side of my head.
Yes. No, I know. Yeah,
but I remember going to the Eroica and just saying, well, I'm, you know, just giving myself over to the music and imagining in my head this huge sort of epic fantasy movie. I was very much into fantasy at the time, sort of Michael Moorcock and Lord of the Rings and stuff. So, and, you know, that is the power of this music too. You can make your own stories out of it.
Yes.
You know, pop music only ever really has one meaning, and that's it.
That's
you listen to it, and they just keep saying the same thing all the time.
Well, that's a controversial statement, but I can see what you mean. And also,
well, I should be so lucky. Is there?
Yeah. What else
can
it mean?
You can't read anything outside that, can you?
Oh, bloody, oh, blada. I mean, it writes itself.
Well, actually, that's probably one of the reasons why I quite like Bob Dylan, in that you can make up any kind of
There's
story
ambiguity.
To lyrics because it doesn't mean anything, mostly.
But also, I think the other thing about pop music is it's very much allied to a memory of a time, isn't it? It's it's associated with a period. You know, I was, you know, the sound of the 70s and so on.
And being a young person when that music is so means so much to you. You know, most of Desert Island Discs, people are choosing music from quite a narrow period of their life.
And whereas there's nothing that says this is the music of the 1590s about classical music. Do you know, it's such, and classical music is such a kind of constraining label because that implies it's just one type of music. But it's like the last 600 or 700 years of music for orchestras, for choruses,
and
for
and
soloists.
And technically, the classical period of classical music was just something quite short in the 19th century, I believe. You know.
So it's weird. And so I find it much more, as you say, much more escapist and much more universal. It suggests more than it defines, if you will.
Charlie Higson and Friends on Scala Radio.
The Charlie Higson and Friends podcasts were originally broadcast on Scala Radio, a radio station that celebrates classical music in all its shapes and sizes. Why not join me, Charles Nove, for breakfast weekday mornings between 7 and 10? It would be wonderful to have you. Scala Radio broadcasts across the UK on DAB Digital Radio, on your smart speaker, the Scala Radio app, and online at scalaradio.co.uk.